got good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot become a creature of death.
Oh. And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the house of pain. Back to the house of pain.
Welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. From classic cults and the cheese in between, the movies are B, but the entertainment is grade A. And I am your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti, and I'm joined by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
How you doing, Jay? Again, we've got another oddity, Fiend Without a Face, but completely different from our last podcast.
Yep, and we're going to get to it right after this.
Brain, it's gone.
That's not all. The entire spinal cord is missing.
But it's incredible.
It's as if some mental vampire were at work.
Does it come from another country or another world? This terrifying menace that G2 must destroy before it's too late.
The image is fading, sir.
There it goes again. Same trouble.
How can they stop this invisible force whose only warning is a weird, blood-chilling sound? Only two people still alive can help this agent find the answers. The girl who could be a spy, and the scientist who could be the destroyer of the entire human race.
We're facing a new form of life. Nobody understands. I believe it feeds on the radiation from your atomic plants, and that it's evil.
You've got to stop them.
There's only one way: shut down your atomic plant.
If I can get through, I can blow up the control room.
Face was distributed by MGM in the U.S. and by Euros Films in the U.K. It was released July 3rd, 1958 in the U.S. and December 1958 in the U.K. Its director was Arthur Crabtree. Now, Arthur Crabtree went on in 1959 to do Horrors at a Black Museum, which is a very different kind of movie. If you haven't gathered from the names here, this is a movie from the U.K. This actually was one of the independent movies put out in the U.K. And you're thinking like, MGM distributed it? This was one of the was one of the few movies that MGM started out trying to distribute some movies from over in England and stuff, and they were like a low budget kind of movie. This was an independent one.
Yeah, it was Amalgamated Productions so that produced it, and MGM picked up the distribution rights.
Yeah, when this is the first of the independents, it wasn't a major studio. Amalgamated being a much smaller. The screenplay was by Herbert Leder, and it was It was based on Amelia Reynolds Long's short story, The Thought Monster, from a 1930 issue of Weird Tales. And actually, this is one of the reasons we'll get to all that after. This is one of the how it got made. I mean, this was a short story that people picked up on and were like, this could really work. All right, so our story opens on a U.S. Air Force Interceptor Command Experimental Station 6 is a long-range radar installation located in Winthrop, Manitoba, Canada, which is kind of funny because it actually was shot in England. But it stands Canada standing in there. Unexplained deaths begin to occur in the general area of a farming village near the American base. Post-mortem autopsies reveal the victims were murdered and their brains and spinal cords are missing from their corpses. And the only clue left behind were two puncture marks at the back of the skull. Locals, however, are convinced that radiation leaks from the radiation from the radar installment's nuclear power experiments are causing the mysterious death. They also think at one point there's a mad GI in the forest killing people. And so Air Force Major Jeff Cummings, that's Marshall Thompson. Yes, the same Marshall Thompson who was in It, the Terror from Beyond Space. He was, again, American actor over there making movies in England. He was, again, at the time, this was when he was making movies. I think what happens, we see when we look at some of the movies, I'm thinking like Crawling Eye and things like right. that. Like, Marshall Tucker and guys like that who were over there, they were older. Like, they had kind of been, not to say they were past their prime, but they were kind of made a bunch here. This was right in the middle Forrest Tucker, right? Marshall Thompson was in the midst of making all his movies now. He was kind of like a current type, but they got to get him over there. He begins to investigate the local deaths as they continue, interviewing the townsfolk while looking for anything unusual. He becomes suspicious of Professor R.E. Walgate, a retired British scientist living near the airbase. Walgate is in the process of writing another book about his ongoing experiments with telekinesis, this time as it applies to thought projection. Major Cummings' suspicion of Walgate's later proved to be correct. The scientist finally admits that he has not only succeeded in developing his mental ability, but in the process created a living thought projection.
Yeah, Walgate's book is called The Principles of Thought Control, and it's called Cybernetics.
Yeah.
The application of logic to electronics.
Yeah. But before they even get to that, I mean, there's one thing here. There's one of the local town folks comes in. There's the scene. And every poster for this movie has the young woman in it, and she's always in her towel. That's the scene. Right. Because he goes, MGM loved that. The original British poster and stuff didn't feature that, but MGM put that on every single poster to put it out there, right? But that scene, when Marshall Thompson's there and he kind of surprised her, it's kind of that awkward, kind of supposed to be funny. Well, the funny part in that scene is when the other guy, I forget his name.
The constable, his name is Gibbons.
Right. He comes in and they have the worst fist fight. Right. Like, oh, yeah, I'll show you.
Four punches thrown, no punches landed.
Nothing. I mean, not even close. Now, I understand that they just were like, just throwing, but it just was really bad. So I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that. Okay, so where are we here? Unknown to Professor Walgate, the nuclear power radiation experiments underway at the U.S. base have greatly enhanced his mental abilities to the point that, through him, his living thought projection has become a malevolent and invisible new life form. Now, he says he gives form to them. He pictures them to be a brain with the little feelers and the final comment. So this is what he pictures his thought projection to be. Not like in Ghostbusters, when they figure, meet your destroyer, and he thinks of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Like, he envisions, like, this is what he picks. Couldn't pick a blonde, but he picks this. Anyway, where are we? It escapes from his laboratory and is now attacking humans as a means of replicating physically through, so still invisible, new versions of itself, all of which are feeding on the base's nuclear-generated power. The invisible creatures eventually attack and kill military personnel at the base, in order to take over the radar station's nuclear reactor. Two of them dial up the power to very dangerous levels. As they do so, the creatures suddenly become visible, which I thought was, good. You kind of keep it, they kind of kept everything kind of hidden for a while, and then they go, oh no, now you can see them, turn the power up. They're now visible. Bodies are revealed, and they are the missing brains with spinal columns stolen from the victims. Their spinal cords have become very flexible and are now sprouted tendrils. Tentacles. Mutations also allow the brain spinal columns to move quickly and even leap distances. Each brain spine has also developed a pair of small eyes at the end of eye stalks. So the slithering creatures attack Walgate's house, where most of the film's principal characters have gathered to discuss the crisis. Some of the brains get inside, breaking through boards in the windows, while others leap off the roof and slither down through the fireplace flue. They're able to kill some with the automatic weapons, and they're shooting them, and they blah, 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 blah. It's like jelly coming out of them. Professor Walgate escapes his home, and he's quickly attacked, which gives Cummings a chance to escape and head back to the base, where he saves the day by blowing up the radar installation's power machinery. Now, once he blows it all up, they all die. Now, he has, three sticks of dynamite? And he puts forth an explosion that... it was a lot more than three sticks of dynamite, that explosion, but again, we're willing to buy that because it makes sense in the story of the movie. Now, that's the very brief synopsis. We decided to go with the very brief one to kind of keep things moving along here so we can talk about this. Now,
right. I wanted to just... Yeah. There's a lot to talk about with this movie. I just wanted to say that we had the Criterion edition, mm-hmm. which is absolutely pristine.
It's the only version available.
It's a great DVD. The movie is only 74 minutes long.
Yep.
There's definitely stock footage of Sabre jets and radar equipment in the sky and moving around.
Yep.
there are plenty of in the background. They must have been doing it near that, but there's plenty of jets taking off and landing. It reminded me of the old Shea Stadium when you'd go to a ball game.
Yep.
I mean, there are times where the jet sounds are actually drowning out the words that are being said. As I mentioned, they call these creatures mental vampires.
Yes, yeah.
And so we'll get into that. But I just wanted to get a couple of things out there before we go on.
You know, okay. So according to MDM, Fiend Without a Face was teamed up in a double feature with The Haunted Strangler, which was the other movie that was... they picked up both of them. They were both produced and directed by the same crew. It's all the same stuff. Both of those were... one's a Karloff movie.
Yeah, it was one of Karloff's last movies, but it was one of his most famous.
Right. Well, the thing, but these were both came out of England, and they were able to pair them together, and so together they earned $350,000 in the U.S. and Canada, and over $300,000 in England and elsewhere. So these movies together, they grossed over $500,000. I mean, well over $500,000, which was a lot.
And the big thing about this double feature. That when it was released in New York, it played at a theater called the Rialto Theater, which was right on 42nd Street in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist now. It's called the New Ambassador, where Disney has all of their plays. But it was the Schlock Theater. Not the X-rated theater, but the Schlock Theater.
It was,
on
it was the House of Horror, they called it.
Right, the House of Horror. Broadway, right at 42nd Street. And the producers actually had a model of this fiend in a glass box.
With bars around it
and hooked up to some electrodes that every so often the tail would move, the body would shake.
And it would play the sound.
But they would play the sound. And it got to the point where there was so many people surrounding this creature that the police had to step in and have them move it.
Yeah, it only lasted 2 days.
Yeah,
they said it was so bad they were stopping traffic. On 42nd Street.
Yeah,
and, which is crazy,
and which made the movie that much more. Yeah. We got to see this.
Yeah,
but the Rialto Theater, and again, I'm old enough to know that the Rialto Theater was a box office at the front, and you walked in and you sat right down.
Yeah.
There was no lobby. There was no candy concessions or any of that stuff that I can remember. So they couldn't put this creature in the box inside the lobby. But so they had it on the street right outside. 42nd Street in Times Square is probably the busiest street in all of the world. So you can understand why the policemen wanted to get this thing out of the public's eye.
Well, that's one of the things they said, that they had actually done, what do you call it, is that they did all the poster work and all that stuff, because you could put all the posters you want up on the wall. But this was such an attraction, and they had no room in their lobby for it. Because if they had room in the lobby, they would have brought people in. And a lot of people stopped and saw it in the street and maybe, you know, ended passing by. And a lot more... By having it not in the lobby of a theater, because they didn't have a lobby, more people got to see it, but it led to a bigger thing. Now, originally, this movie was originally released in Detroit first,
right,
before it was there. And that was in the MGM's house there. And that only showed, like, MGM's main run movies.
Right.
And in fact, it was Gigi the week before this opened.
Right, and the manager was kind of ticked off.
Yeah, he was furious.
Bring one of these up.
Yeah.
They actually wanted the producers said... You know, the manager wanted to know how could he bring this to the public's eye, and the producer said, well, why don't you put a coffin in the lobby? And he says, I'm not going to have all of my Gigi fans, my Gigi customers, traipsing over a coffin in the lobby,
right,
so that they can come back next week and see this schlock.
Yeah, yeah. Let's step over a coffin in the middle of the lobby, which I thought was kind of funny. Anyway. So, along with that, 5 months later, obviously it opened later, it opened, it created a big problem in England. It premiered at the Ritz Theatre in Leicester Square in London's West End. The British Board of Film Censors had demanded a number of cuts be made before release, and finally granted the film an X certification. We talked about the X cert before.
Yeah.
But the critics were still aghast at its horrifying special effects. Now, the questions were raised in Parliament as to why British censors had allowed Fiend Without a Face to be released at all, and it was What's the British film industry thinking by trying to beat Hollywood at its own game of overdosing of blood and gore? And they were just appalled by how dare this movie come out. But it's a British movie. And again, we are looking at this in current eyes. This movie's tame. I mean, compared to anything nowadays. But in 1958, it has a lot. Think about it. I Married a Monster from Outer Space, 1958. This is 1958. There's not one drop of blood in anything in I Married a Monster from Outer Space at all. And people get killed. Like, they kill all kinds of people. Here, every time the brain gets shot, it would ooze out the blood. It's blood. I mean, it's thick blood, but it's blood.
But in black and white, it looks black. I mean, if it had been red coming out, like some of the Hammer films, where they would just do lots of blood, it might not have gotten released.
Well, they got Surdaxes too. But I mean, but the thing is, with the Hammer films, this is one of the reasons. Remember, Hammer made Quartermass, Quartermass in the Pit, XT, all those things. This movie kind of spelled the end of Hammer's making those films. And Hammer started moving into their gothic. Now, they made a lot more money with Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Mummy, right, and stuff like that, of course. But that's part of what happened. Also, there's something I'm going to note here. Forrest J. Ackerman represented the writer Long, who was based on Hers, and brokered the sale of the Thought Monster to the film's producers. He loved this. He thought this was great. He remembers this from when he was younger, and he was able to help broker that deal, which is important. One of the things happened, though, during the filming, screenwriter Letter was originally sent to direct the film, but being an American, he was unable to obtain a British work permit at the time, so Crabtree replaced him as director. Thompson later said that when the director showed up on his first day of shooting and looked at the script, he claimed that it was not a film he'd been hired to direct, to do a monster film. So it was a heated argument with the producers, and Crabtree left the set and didn't show up, so Thompson directed the movie for a few days to get it going. Which is kind of funny because him being American couldn't get a thing either, but the British guy left, so let's go. It was made entirely in England. The Canadian setting was chosen because it appealed to both the American and the British Commonwealth, and they were trying to get those audiences. And it was easy to replicate using English shooting locations. The U.S. Air Force stock aviation footage, of course, was also established, the military base's setting, and to pad out the film's meager running time. The producers used primarily... American-Canadian actors working in the UK, plus a few British actors dubbed by Americans because they didn't want to have the accents.
Yeah, well, the Dr. Walgate,
he's supposed to be British.
Yeah, he is British, but he's also, he was a major character actor for many, many years in British films, and even some of the big production numbers in the 40s and 50s. And here he's an older guy, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe he passed away less than a year later after this movie. Right.
So when you see the creatures, this is a case of, you know, they couldn't be a guy in a suit, so they were done with stop motion, which was really, really rare for a movie with this low a budget. And the director of effects sequences was Florence von Nordorf, with the actual special stop motion done in Munich by his partner, K.L. Ruppel. Peter Nielsen headed up the practical effects crew. But they had done the special effects. Oh, here they are. Nielsen, Rupert, and Nordorf all together. They did the effects. All of them together were the guys credited with all the stop motion effects. Now, there has been some talk that this movie's special stop motion was on a par with Harryhausen. It's not. And I'm not trying to be mean, and I'm not trying to demean what these men did, because they did a good job, but it's clearly not on Harryhausen's level. But Harryhausen, 1958, so think about it. What's Harryhausen making, right?
Seven Voyages in Bed.
That came out in 78.
Yeah, but think about 54 when he did.
We had Seven Voyages in Bed released the same year. So he's working on the next project already. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can look at any of Harryhausen's stuff. You can go back to the puppet tunes. You can go back to the earliest. Go back to Mighty Joe Young when he's working with Willis O'Brien on that. Like, this is not the same level. This is clearly not the same. It's good. It's just not the same level. They move very jerky. It's definitely a cut above, like, marionetted kind of things. Like, it would look really weird if they were marionetted. I'm thinking, like, Giant Claw, just in many versions of brains. But clearly, this is not that same level. And again, these men did the best they could with what they had, and it's effective, but it's certainly not, Harryhausen level kind of stuff.
No, I mean, again, there was not an awful lot of stop motion animation. I mean, when you go back other than Harryhausen, there was not anyone, not even George Pal, did the stop motion. He did a lot of in-camera effects.
He did the change-o faces, too. He liked that. Yeah, the change-o faces.
But, in watching this, I thought some of the stop motion was effective. It was good. But then other times, it looked like they rushed it. And you could see where it was herky-jerky. But the creatures themselves, when they're finally visible, are they look like brains. I mean, they do look like what the spinal column. Now, in the beginning of the movie, as you're watching this, you don't see these creatures. All you have is the rustling of grass
and the impression.
Thing, but again, that's effective too. So that when you finally do see these creatures, and again, if they've got this creature on a poster on the outside of the movie theater, you pretty much know what you're going to get once you see it. I have no idea whether they had these up there, other than just the Fiend Without a Face.
Yeah, no, they did. As a lobby card. The poster would always had her in her robe, right. Had either Marshall Thompson, and it had somebody else always, and they always were there, and they would say Fiend Without a Face, and it always had the brain up in it, yeah. Like the, you know,
so.
Kind of thing.
So you knew it was coming. I mean, the
yeah, but again, just because it's on the poster, I mean
well, no, but just well, no, but like the crawling eye. I mean, on the eye is in the middle of that poster. So you know, with the name The Crawling Eye,
yeah,
that you're going to see an eye.
Well, that's why the Trollenberg Terror is the better name.
Right.
But I'm saying is, but how many movies? I'm thinking Creature from the Haunted Sea, right?
Right.
Where
no.
The poster looks really good, and then Cookie Monster comes out of the water, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, I mean, you didn't know if you're going to get, like, maybe that was just what they did in the poster. It doesn't matter. The whole point is that what you get here is exactly what it's advertised to be. I think one of the things that came across here is... It definitely tried to take things from other movies in tone.
Well, again, it
reminded me of Them a little bit in the way it's kind of procedural and how they're going about. It's kind of a not police procedural, but they're kind of like, we got to figure this out. And he's going through trying to logically figure things out. I mean, when he gets locked in the crypt, he's doing things. He's not a police officer,
no.
But he's trying to put things together. Where other people are just like, I don't know what's going on. It's kind of like what they did in Them. And again, not the same level. But when they're kind of like procedurally going through figuring this stuff out,
right? Well, you know what was happening at this time in 1957, the Russians launched Sputnik, and so there was this quasi fear in the United States that if we don't get to space fast enough, they're going to wipe us out with atomic bombs. And and I remember that as a child in grammar school, we would do these crazy things like
duck and cover,
like hide under desk.
Yeah.
Now, this movie is definitely a powerful movie from the point of view of it's a Cold War, has the understory of a Cold War, and more atomic power is needed. And that, and the more atomic power you have, the closer we are to Armageddon. And I like that part of the movie. Now.
Well, that's the whole thing too. He flat out says him. He goes, if we can, you know, here's Siberia. We can watch them right in their own backyards, and we can tell. Like, it's just so, like, it's so different a film at some points than it is at other points. It's not a monster movie. This isn't. I mean, it's got its monster movie parts to it, but the beginning part of this, this could have been a war movie.
Right.
I mean, if instead of it being. You know, fiends without, like, they were creatures. If they were sleeper cell, like not sleeper cell, but like they were like Russians invading through Canada, you know, kind of thing, like or something like that. This is a very different movie. It's a war movie.
That's right. I mean, the thing here, the love interest here between was it
Beth, right?
Beth,
yeah.
and Marshall and Thompson,
yeah.
And Marshall
Cummings,
Thompson,
yeah.
it was added, and it reminded me of the. Of one of the opening lines in the original King Kong, when the Broadway producer comes onto the ship and he hasn't brought a girl with him for Denham to take with him, and he says, "Why must you have a pretty face?" And he says, "The public, God bless him, wants him." And so, I mean, with the shower scene again, it was pretty racy. She wasn't. I mean, it's hard to tell whether she was wearing anything or not, but it was pretty racy because you saw the top of her cleavage, and when she comes out. She's just got a towel from the top of her cleavage to the top of her thighs.
And they put all that in. You know, MGM wanted that all over the poster.
Yeah.
I think the funny part is, though, it's 1958. So, again, our last episode when we covered I Married a Monster from Outer Space, and all we heard was, Bill, the entire time, just constantly her saying that over and over again. Beth could not be any more different than Marge.
No.
Beth was, you know, again, that's the other thing that reminded me of them. Think about when the doctors, two of them, and they get there kind of
Dr.
thing.
Medford.
Medford, two of them, right? They get there. She's like, do this. And he's like, well, I'm not telling you. I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Like, Beth's very into, like, okay. And at the end, they kind of made her wishy-washy. Like, yeah. Don't leave. Like, she has been no-nonsense the whole time. I guess, I mean, her brother's the one that dies, and you know, kind of thing. And she's supposed to be this kind of, not say simple, but their farmer. He's a farmer. They're worried about the cows producing milk, and she's working just typing his the professor's stuff up. I mean, but she doesn't take any crap the entire movie. And at the end, I think they went away from that a little bit. But again, it's now, you know, now the brain has already attacked her. You know, it jumps up. That's actually the most famous picture. To me, that's the most famous scene from there. When the brain has got its, the column around her throat choking her and is trying to suck out her brain. It's actually at school, because we have to have a little avatar for our, like our, for our, you know, and most of the teachers have their picture or have a math thing or whatever. Mine is that picture. It's of the brain trying to suck her brain out. That's what I have. And parents have asked me, what's that? I said, well, if you don't know, I'm not telling you.
You're not weird, Jay.
No, but you know what, though? I guarantee you, that describes education probably to the zenith. Now we're gonna, you know, but that's another story. But what I'm saying is, to me, that's always very iconic looking, and people kind of can look at that and know that. And even people who have never seen Fiend Without a Face, that maybe never seen the movie, the idea, when you look back at, like, even things, I mean, I'm not saying, I don't remember exactly who's on The Simpsons or, like, Family Guy, but, like, you know, it's one of those things, like King Kong, Godzilla, a brain shooting through there. You might not know the movie, but you know the reference.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? And I think that's one of the important things when you see this. Now, like my dad said, this is the Criterion. That's the only way this is available, right? The Criterion on Amazon is $28.19. Again, that flight, that price fluctuates. You can rent it on Amazon for $2.99. Now, on YouTube, somebody from, I think it might, it looks like German because I don't speak German, but it might, or might be whatever. I don't think it's French, but anyway, someone over there has put a rip of the Criterion up online. So you can actually watch the Criterion on YouTube. But again, you have to sit there and watch it on YouTube. And if you make it big, it's not like it's not like it's from a Blu-ray transfer. This has never seen a Blu-ray transfer in 1080, you know, whatever. What certain movies don't lend themselves well to the more high def transfers, and we've said this with the black and white Harryhausen movies, is that the Blu-rays really sharpen everything up and make his effects look better. But sometimes you see when he's layered three layers together, you can see the layer difference. Here, the stock footage will not look any better. The stock footage will look worse. It'll look more like stock footage. The stuff with them interacting will look the same. It'll just be crisper. I don't think the brains would benefit from a 1080 viewing of this compared to like the cleaned up Criterion.
Right.
I think they look as good as they should look. I think they need a little bit of that dark. I think they need a little bit of that, not say fuzz, because it's not fuzzy, but I think they need a little bit of that for you to buy them, because the stop motion was a little herky-jerky. As you said, rushed. That is the best way to describe it. It's rushed stop motion. When stop motion is rushed, things move too herky-jerky. Stop motion always has that unnatural movement to it, even Harryhausen. This is why his stuff is so good. When you watch Harryhausen do anything, I'm thinking like the skeletons in even the one skeleton in Seven Points of Sinbad, the way he moves, it's not perfectly smooth CG, which is why CG is so wrong to your eye. Your eye says that's real, it's got movement, it's got mass, it's happening. These have movement and mass. They're real. They look like they could really be someone's brain ripped out of their skull and now coming to kill you. I think, though, it would be hurt by a more high-def version. I mean, Criterion doesn't put out a bad product. Criterion, my Criterion's at home, Seventh Samurai, you know, Steve Zazu and The Life Aquatic, those Criterions that you spend the money on, the Godzilla Criterion, you spend money on Criterion because it's worth it. When I bought this, when it first came out, it probably was at the time $30, and $30 for a DVD was crazy, you know? But that's what happened. Because why? Because you want something you wanted, and you knew we were going to get a quality product. The specials on there actually are really good, too. They have a whole bunch of trailers for the movie. They have a bunch of other trailers, and that little conversation they had with the director.
But they must have indexes that go on for maybe 50 separate pages. Yeah. You have to read them, or you can look at them. They have a lot of the lobby cards.
Yeah, all for all different movies that different tie movies. Into it, too.
Yeah.
Because they made a good point. A lot of this stuff, when you talk about Quatermass, especially in England, Quatermass was a TV series, It was like their...
PBS type of stuff.
Yeah, kind of thing. But it was like their show.
A few years
and then,
before.
But that led into all the Quartermass movies. And Quartermass were huge hits over there. And again, in America, maybe we don't appreciate them as much because we know them as X the Unknown. We know it as And the Enemy Within. They changed it.
5,000 miles
yeah,
from space.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. They had to give them other names because Quartermass means nothing to people in America because we weren't raised on that. And it's the same way, like, how sometimes things don't translate really well. Like, movies that do well in America don't translate well overseas because it's just, it's very different. Quartermass was not something that Americans grew up on. You know, I liken it this way to, I think, something like in the realm of like a Doctor Who. Doctor Who was huge over in England before it was huge here because Doctor Who's what they grew up on and they always had the bigger following. Different kind of stuff.
Yeah, what I liked about this movie from my because I hadn't seen this movie in a long, long mm-hmm. time, is that at 54 minutes, the plot is finally explained. So, again, we know that there's a brain creature because of our just growing up and knowing all of these things. But if you came to this blind and you didn't know anything about this movie, it could be anything because you don't see anything until... And at 54 minutes in, the plot is now explained. It's called materialized thought. And that's when you start seeing the creatures. Now, at that point, or just before that point, Thompson makes the statement. He said, "We're all human here. We're not monsters from outer space." And so that ties in the movie, but there are other things in the movie that, again, if you know me, when I do this, I'm a continuity fanatic, but because of the budget, there's one thing that happens all the time in every movie, and this one is the flashlight goes out every time. The Marshall Thompson grabs a flashlight to go to the cemetery to see
right to check the body
to
of
check
the
body
for the mayor,
of
right?
the mayor
yeah,
right
yeah yeah
and he's not in that thing 3 minutes, the door closes
and it's stuck
and the yeah. flashlight goes out, but he's a smoker, so he's got the ability to light matches.
We got the candles down there. The best is that he uses up all the air
like
how much there's. It's a big crypt. It's not like it's like you're in a coffin. Like, it's a big crypt. They used up all that air pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know.
But again, it was it moves the plot along, yeah, and then he gets saved by his buddy, the captain.
Yeah.
But the one thing that is very noticeable when you have a low budget is that they never reshoot scenes. There is one scene early in the movie where the mayor and the girl are with the colonel in his office. And they're having a talk about, is the radiation causing the cows not to give good milk? Well, there is a fly on the mayor's jacket.
Yes.
And they don't cut the scene.
No.
Today, they would cut the scene and they probably would have Aaron Rodgers hit it with a golf club. But it looks real, because if you're sitting in an office and you're talking to somebody important and a fly is on your thing, if you don't notice it, it's gonna stay yeah. there.
Well, the best is it's there, and it's not like it's not there, and then they're back. They
right.
they shot that scene straight
through. Right.
So the fly's there the whole time, so it doesn't mess with continuity that way. It'd be one thing if the fly was there, then it wasn't there, then it was there, then it wasn't there. That would really, I think, bother you even more because that's continuity. That's like head on the beer,
yeah.
you know, kind of thing. So,
yeah. yeah, and you know I'm a stickler.
Oh,
I know.
You're willing to believe everything up to that point, but not that the beer had moved.
just as a because of that, we were watching another movie yesterday with it was a sword and sandal movie, and the guy's getting a shave, and he's half his face is shaved. Then they cut back, and somebody else walks in the room, and the guy's face is all—it's got the shaving cream all back on it
yeah.
again. I said to my wife, I said, "That's it, click," and it went off. And then we went back to watching something else.
Yeah. So, like I said, folks, you know, this is a movie, again, a lot of people may know it. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I can't remember the last time I've ever... I mean, I had to buy this on Criterion to see it, because I don't remember this ever being on TV. I can't remember the last time TCM showed it. I can't remember the last time I even... It's a movie that people know the name. Like, you type in... Like, if you're typing into, like, Wikipedia, Fiend... And then it automatically fills in without a face, because it's like must be what people search, right? It's no joke. It's something that's out there, but it's not readily available to most people unless you go and seek it out. And I think that's one of the problems. And this reminds me that, and again, I know it's a British movie, but I'm thinking of Abominable Snowman here. Crawling Eye kind of had its day, you know, kind of like it had its thing in Crawling Eye. But the Abominable Snowman, most people never seen it. Why? It's not readily available. And again, this is on a Criterion, so you can get it. And it's on YouTube, so you could watch it. It's just that I think people know this and they just haven't ever had the chance to see it. And I think that one of the reasons why, even though the brain is iconic, it's one of the reasons why maybe this movie is not... People don't always include this when they talk about great science fiction movies of the 50s. It's a name that you heard and you know the brain monster, but people are like, I don't remember if I've seen that or not. They don't know, like, they only think of it as just maybe the monster, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the thing here with the... Maybe this is a nuclear reactor that is producing this atomic power. The these creatures have somehow, as they infiltrate the brains, they get in. They actually have destroyed some of the rods in the reactor, yeah. And so they need to go get more rods. Well, but that implies that this thing is going to. It's like a chain reaction explosion. When Thompson blows the place up
with the 3 sticks of dynamite.
Whether he's got 3 or 300, he blows up an atomic reactor. Now, where we live here, we're not that far from a place called Indian Point, and that's the Con Ed nuclear reactor site. If there's a gallon of hot water, so to speak, that gets into the Hudson River, God forbid it. I mean, it's like all of New York State is now under watch. Right. So that to me is, well, just no, but it happens just before the ending, and that's why when he blows the place up. And then he drives back to the girl, and they kiss, and that's the happy sappy ending. The rest of the country is there's nuclear fallout.
It's in Manitoba, Canada, so it's not it's not like you're talking. It's not like in Beast from the Other Fathoms, where they're in the Antarctic, where they're nowhere near people. People live here.
Yes,
right. And it's like, should we be shielding our eyes from what? I don't know, fallout, like, you know, kind of thing. Like, he's basically setting off a huge bomb.
Right.
Right. And basically what you're doing is like, it's like, we're going to annihilate everything kind of bomb, you know, kind of thing. The bomb, you know, kind of thing, as Quint would say, you know, kind of thing. But that's really all. I mean, again, you have to kind of suspend disbelief and, you know, take whatever right. there. And I know that bothers you. But what I'm saying is if that had turned into like this being then, you know, on the beach at this point kind right. of thing, well, I don't think we'd have had the upbeat ending they were hoping for.
Well, you know, but On the Beach was made the exact same time.
Right.
It's a different story.
Different story, though.
But,
yeah.
But I mean, but the after effects of a nuclear reactor going, I mean, they've talked about it here. They're actually shutting down this Indian Point power plant because it's not safe anymore.
Yeah.
And there's been a moratorium on building more nuclear reactors in the United States because of the safety factors.
Yeah.
Now, I have one last little thing to get in about the movie. When the creatures are attacking the folks in the house,
yeah,
they run down to the cellar and they get wood planks and they board up the windows, almost like the windows were boarded up in Night of the Living Dead.
Yep.
But they also move this humongous desk in front of the doors. And whenever a creature comes in, if it tries to get in, or they shoot it through the window,
right.
But they don't do anything with the fireplace.
No,
and the creatures come down from the fire, and that's where the creatures get in. Now you would think that they would have put the doors locked. They would have put at least something in front of the fireplace. But they had to show the creatures getting in. They die by bullets, so they're not. It's not like you have to. You have to use bazookas to get them,
yeah.
And then there's that
or a dog to kill it, like in I Married a Monster on the Face. Bullets are useless, but a dog.
Right, and then there's that scene that Jason loves with the brain on top of the girl's head.
Well, because they attack the other guy, he is. He's the
and he died. He dies rather quickly.
Well, it guts on him, and then I love the doctor just kind of like, well. I guess he's dead. Yeah. You know, he like doesn't even try to help him. The doctor is like 1,000% useless in this movie. He comes in, he's like, oh, it's okay. You only had like a heart attack. Just sit and rest. Like, sit and rest. Like, but anyway, the whole point is that scene right there of that's actually, there's actually a model of that coming out from our guys at Earthbound. And it's the man with the thing, which to me is not the
no,
guy.
It should be
if it was
girl.
The woman, I would love it. Because the original Big Head... Big heads are 3/4 scale. The original one, which I have at my house, which has not been built yet, is the 1-for-1 of the... There's a stump of wood with the brain, with the stem coming out, and another brain attached to it. It is humongous, and it's Freeman Out of Phase, and it was one of those... You know, people are like, that's just a great piece, but people are like, Well, but it doesn't show the monster. I'm like, it does show the monster. It just looks so different. Instead of being a head,
yeah,
it's their whole body.
Yeah, the one I had built was a 1/8 scale, which is much, much smaller. And it's basically the same thing. There's three of the brains,
yes, yeah,
in the woods with the tree.
Yeah.
And but again, as creatures go, it's fine. I mean, yeah, if you can accept the crawling eye being as big as an elephant, then you can accept these.
So, all right, folks. So again, if you want to leave us feedback about Fiend Without a Face, you want to give us, you know, anything, please email us through the show. We love hearing from you guys, even if it's like, hey, I remember this as a kid, or hey, I remember seeing this when I was whatever. Like maybe you went to a drive-in and it was playing there, whatever the case might be. We love to hear from you. Of course, any feedback that comes in, we'll of course share with everybody right through the show. You know, next up, we're looking at actually doing 1958's The Fly, which is another case of, you know, science kind of going wrong and where it can happen. And I think a lot of that ties in here. We spent a lot of time in 1957. We're not spending a bunch of time in 1958. It's that time when America's kind of going through their thing. You know, there's still the Cold War, so all this stuff happening stuff. So you had one last thing, Dad, you wanted to say?
Yes, before we go, remember, mad science spawns evil fiends.
All right, folks, so that about do us. Again, this is our, we're at 1 year anniversary. This is the March, 2017 episode. So this is, it's been a good run, and we're going to keep going. And, you know, again, be on the lookout for stuff from us. We're always trying to improve and, you know, change things up and maybe, you know, have some special editions coming out or special episodes. So with that said, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo. Once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc., are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?